Nabonidus claimed that he revived the custom because he miraculously discovered an ancient text instructing him to do so. He came across this text while excavating. He writes, "At that time, the holy precinct was an abandoned place. I removed the rubble of its ruins. I set eyes on the temple, and its foundation terrace became visible. Inside it, I set eyes on inscriptions of old earlier kings and an old inscription of the high priestess of Ur, sister of Rim-Sin, who ruled in the late 19th century BC, so that I made it as in the old days." He also records that since it had been so long since a ruler had done this, that the customs were forgotten. But once again, he consulted the past. "I set eyes on an ancient stele, on which was depicted the image of the high priestess. I carefully looked into the old clay and wooden tablets and did exactly as in the old days." As you can imagine, many historians are big fans of Nabonidus because he is so actively interested in consulting historical documents, and archaeologists are envious of his near miraculous ability to reconstruct an entire temple just by looking at a few foundation stones. Other examples of Nabonidus referring to earlier rulers exist in inscriptions that date throughout his reign. And even though we can joke a little bit about his focus on the past, once again, since he was a usurper, he would be especially interested in looking for ways to justify his actions, to find comparable behavior in earlier rulers, and probably seek out these very conservative customs as a way to show that he had a legitimate claim to rule. In his third year, the king campaigned in Lebanon and northern Arabia, and in 552 BC, decided to move his residence to a desert oasis at Tema in northern Arabia. He never sets out his justifications for this, so we have to speculate. We know that there was widespread worship of the moon god in this region, and this, in concert with Nabonidus's attentions to cults, especially of lunar deities, leads us to speculate that he was motivated by his religious beliefs. Nabonidus did not abandon his throne. He left his son and successor Belshazzar as his regent in Babylon. But especially in later years, the move was interpreted as the abandonment of the god Marduk, especially by the priests of Marduk who were writing the histories that have survived. But it could have been an attempt to control the trade routes that had opened across the desert. These have been a somewhat mysterious presence for us. I refer to them in passing as areas that were difficult to control, but they did provide important resources for whatever empire was controlling Mesopotamia at the time. Whatever Nabonidus's motivation, one result was that the New Year festival in Babylon could not be performed for the 9 years that Nabonidus was absent. And we should not underestimate the effects of this in creating a general uneasiness with his rule. Here he had gone to so much trouble to find historical precedent, but at the same time he was behaving in a very radical way by moving his capital out of Babylon. Nabonidus returned after almost 10 years, and there's little doubt that what prompted his return was a growing Persian threat in the east. At this time, we can start to see a much more extreme shift in his cultic loyalties. When Nabonidus returned, the temples of other gods, including the Esagila, were renamed for Sin. Within a few years of Nabonidus's return, the Persians were able to capture Babylon in 539, and it does not appear to have been that difficult, so they may well have benefited from this dissatisfaction with Nabonidus's religious behavior.